Hello, everyone. My name's Jamie, and I am definitely an alcoholic. And I am surrounded by friends tonight that I love dearly and deeply with my heart. Your family, and I am so glad that you're here tonight to share this evening with me. And I know that there's one person here tonight that needs to hear my story. I have no idea what I'm about to say. I truly have tried to take the advice of people that have been up here and have done this before. And they said, I need to let God drive for this hour, this 42, 3 minutes. But nobody's counting. This would be one night that I am more than happy to keep my comments to 3 minutes or less. Apparently that's not going to happen. I do know that I had a life 36 years before AA, and then I've had 2.5 years, 2 years and 10 months and 12 hours after AA. But I'm not counting. It's truly not about counting. I do know that my 2.5 years in this program, my sobriety date is January 3rd, 2003. Those 2.5 years have helped to explain the insanity that I felt for the first 36 years of my life. And for that, I am extremely grateful. I am very humbled to be able to be up here tonight. I remember my first speaker meeting when I first came in, and I was overwhelmed and thought that if I ever had the opportunity to get enough time and be asked, I don't have any idea what I would say. And that's true. I have no idea what I'm going to say. And Johnny pretty much took the wind out of my sails tonight. He said I couldn't swear, and he said that I couldn't talk about my slutty stories, so that leaves me with nothing to say. That's what friends are for. I am going to start kind of in the middle because I really had the gift when I first came in of being surrounded by people that I've learned have a sobriety that I really like and that I care about. And there were a few instrumental people that helped me to understand this disease. Dr. Rick was one of them. He's the one that reads at every meeting he chairs the doctor's opinion. It talks about this being a threefold disease, one of mind, body, and spirit. I knew that I couldn't touch alcohol again 6 months before I came into this program, but what I didn't know was that it was insanity of my mind and emptiness of my soul that was driving me nuts. And I am grateful for those 6 months, and I'll talk about those in a little while. But the other person is Beth. I don't think she's here tonight, but I used to go to the Sunday morning meeting in the small room, and Beth always qualified by talking about the black hole that was inside her. And I never knew that that black hole was not having God in my life. I tried to fill that black hole with many things over the years, always restless and irritable and discontented, at times finding contentment only to be really, really, I can't swear, upset when things don't go my way. What can I say? Some habits are hard to break. But the other thing that I was given by a dear man who's not here tonight is Chuck C's book, A New Pair of Glasses. And that book talked about perspective and perception. And there's a simple, simple diagram in that book that shows a dot outside of a circle with many, many, many dots inside. And that dot outside the circle was me before I embraced this program. And always the person outside looking in, wanting what you had, again, being really upset when things didn't go my way, and feeling like I had some sort of mission in this life, some place that I was supposed to be, but not knowing where that was and how to get it, because I had to get it. And the other diagram, I believe, is the diagram of the dot inside the circle. And us as AAers who work the steps and embrace God and His path for us and don't try to travel our own path, that's a person living among others, loving others, being there for each other, being there for God and to do His work. And that was so simple to read, but so mind-blowing for somebody who fancied herself a college-educated chick from Wisconsin. I was born February 15th, 1967 in Madison, Wisconsin. I had to turn off the Badger game tonight because there are a couple of things that wreck my serenity really quickly, and that's when the Badgers lose, so I didn't want to risk it. They look like they were ahead, that they would probably win, but in case they didn't, I needed to turn the TV off, so if anybody knows, you can tell me after the meeting. I'm the youngest in a family of five. I'm the youngest by 9 years. My sister Sam is 9 years older than me, and I have a sister that's 18 years older than me, and the rest fall in between. My mom always called me her tag-along and her special gift and her beautiful little baby. And I loved feeling that specialness. I kind of grew up as an only child. My sister Sam left the house at age 18, not of her own accord. I love my family. I really do. But we're incredibly dysfunctional. I don't think anybody else here has one of those, but I do. And because I'm special and it's all about me. But some of my earliest memories are of a father who was a World War II veteran. He helped found the Wisconsin Air National Guard, and he ran a tight ship, and he was Norwegian. And I don't know if that has anything to do with anything, but he had a really insane sense of humor that I share at times, and still, that was when I knew I was recovering, is when my sense of humor started coming back, because nothing seemed funny in the end. Fear entered my life at a very early age. He would come home from the club, and all hell would break loose. I didn't know what was going on. I always had a dog growing up. Animals have always been a sense of stability and love, unconditional love in my life. And my big old standard poodle and I would hunker down and weather the storm. And when it finally would abate, I would sometimes sneak into my mom's room and crawl up on her bed and pet her and tell her everything was going to be okay, not knowing if the storm was going to rage again or if that was it for the night. I developed, I think, at that time, the need to take care and to make sure that everything was okay. I'm finding in sobriety that perfectionism is one of my character defects, and it has crippled me at times in terms of working the steps, trying to do them perfectly, and that's not possible. There's you know, it's God's show. But I do know I used to barf. Is that okay? Before ice skating lessons, before tennis lessons, before dancing lessons. I used to swim really fast. I beat one girl on the swim team who was like the fastest, and she's like, you should go out. And there was no way I was ever going to do something like that, because I was so scared. And that's me. And I didn't have a father or a mother that encouraged risk-taking. We always took the safe, you know, road. And that in itself was somewhat crippling. But that's just the way it was. My family did give me the gift of traveling. We traveled during the summers in cars. That was the only way we could afford it. And it was a little more traditional back then for families to take big car vacations. And I think that those car trips were my experience first connecting with God. I remember the first time I saw the Rocky Mountains, and the tears truly came to my eyes, and the awesomeness of it. And we logged many miles. I was able to go to England with my father and my mother when he went over for a guard drill and visited the family that he stayed with in World War II. They, being older, I think I developed an appreciation for a lot of things that kids my age weren't exposed to, and I truly am grateful for my family, and today love them. My father died about 4 or 5, it'll be 5 years in January, and that's an amends I still need to make. He left without me being able to tell him I could love him, that I do love him. And our last words to each other before he died were very ugly and very rotten. And I was able to be at his bedside when he died. I was able to write his obituary drunk, but it did come from my heart. That was the only way that I could process that kind of grief for many, many, many years. I grew up, like I said, very afraid, and didn't want to suffer any wrath that my father would put upon me if I did something naughty. So I really tried to excel at school, and I was a very good student up through the time I graduated high school, always a high honor roll student. Played the oboe for 6 years, very straight-laced. I went to a party once in high school, drank a beer, was afraid that my family would find out and I would get in trouble, so I went home. I graduated from high school in 1985 and enrolled in the University of Wisconsin at Madison. That school recently, and I think year after year, is ranked by the Princeton Review as the number one party school in the country. And I had told somebody once that I learned to drink at the UW, and he's like, no, alcoholics never learn to drink. And that is the truth. But I do, again, recall intense fear. I was feeling like the outsider. Looking in, I went from a 600-person high school to a school of over 43,000 students, and would be in a lecture with as many students as were in my high school. And the big fish, who was special, felt like she was drowning. And I remember being at my first kegger, and again, feeling just sick to my stomach and on the outside. I never dated in high school. I, was afraid to be in a relationship, afraid, you know, my story's about fear. And that's the other thing I didn't mention, was that Clancy, when the first time I got to hear Clancy, he talked about the emotional spring inside, and that's where I lived, with an emotional spring. And for a long, long time, I didn't know how to calm that bounce inside me, that feeling like I wanted to vomit all the time, unless I was at peace with my animals or with horses. I used to show dogs, and that area of my life was very sustaining. However, I got to the UW, was going to be a veterinarian, and felt like a little fish in a big pond, outside of the circle, looking in. And got to that party, and somebody handed me a beer, and I drank one, and it was all right. And then I drank the other, and everything was okay from then on. That was my release. I went from really not drinking to drinking a lot all the time. I would be absolutely frozen over a paper that I needed to write, and I would spend the week thinking about it, and then I would go out the night it was due and come home at 2 a.m. and write the paper really drunk, and just stumbled through my first few semesters of school. I had this desire to be a veterinarian and a huge fear of math. And knew that calculus was one of the prerequisites. And decided that I couldn't do calc, so I was going to change my major. And I looked at my list of credits, and the most credits that I had were in English. And so I was going to be an English teacher. And that's what I did. I changed my major for fear of calculus. And I think it was probably a year after that, they dropped the calculus requirement. Seriously. And I had graduated, I believe, at that point. But it's so silly. It is so silly to me now that that kind of fear could drive me where I didn't want to go. I've never used my teaching degree as a teacher. I graduated from the university with okay grades. They weren't great. My first two semesters really sucked. And I do remember graduating and that fear seeping in. It just came in, and there was no way that I was good enough to get a teaching job. And I had been working at a veterinary clinic for a while, and took a job as a teacher's assistant, and worked that way for many years. I just hopscotched around from job to job, feeling unsettled and unworthy and lost. The one constancy has always been my animals. I showed Australian Shepherds around the state of Wisconsin and Illinois, Iowa, and the Midwest, and had a lot of success in that area. And I do recall partying a lot at the dog shows, and there were times that I was too hungover to be the show secretary. Just a real chaotic life. I had brief relationships early on. Finally, and I don't know if this is appropriate, but it's my story, lost my virginity at age 22, and remember feeling really empty after that, looking again for that love that I couldn't find, and I cried after it. I cried and cried and cried and felt really, really empty, but yet continued to search for that relationship that would make me whole. I fell in love and was engaged to a guy from England, and truly loved him. My alcoholism was ebbing and waning. I could at that point stop when I needed to, pull it together, and be okay. He couldn't come to America without a visa, and the way the United States runs it is that you need to have a fiancé visa, and then they get about 3 months for you to get married. And so we had this really long-distance relationship, and then he was set to come over. We were going to get married September 10th of 1993, I think, and he called the week before and said he couldn't do it. And I remember at that time for a long time. That was where I went from feeling really happy to feeling really messed up, like the bottom had dropped out of my world. And that is when it all took off. I set about searching out bars and relationships and destroying myself with really risky behaviors. Cocaine is a part of my story. Ironically, you know, that's a drug that finally in the end disgusted me, because I had this thing that after my dad died that he wouldn't be real happy with me doing cocaine. Not that he'd be happy that I was drowning myself in alcohol. However, I did get into a relationship that lasted for 5.5 years, and it was again an attempt to fill up that hole. His two children were dumped on our doorstep probably a week or two after we moved in and proceeded to live with us for the extent of that relationship, and they were truly something that I find to be a gift in my life, and that I am very happy that they were a part of my life at that time. But that said, it was a relationship that involved much drinking. The first time that I came into AA, it was after a night of drinking, and the person that I was in the relationship with had me up against the wall and was strangling me. And I looked into his eyes and he looked into mine, and we both started crying and realized the insanity of that very moment. I went into AA pretty broken, but not defeated. And when I opened the big book that time around, I kept reading it and looking for reasons not to be an alcoholic. I wasn't ready. I wasn't going to surrender the relationship or the children, which I was totally in love with. And just wasn't done. And that is the bottom line today for anybody that walks in the room. Either you're done or you're not. And either you're ready to embrace these steps or you're not. And at that point in my life, I needed to experience a little more drama and a little more loss of self-respect and a little more emptiness and a little more humiliation. I finally got my first DUI, finally, and I say finally because I drank and drove many, many times in, I don't know what year it was, but it was within 3 years of my second one. And it was the result of being in a drunk fight, getting mad and leaving and going to the bar and slamming drinks to try to make it all feel better. And then I'm going to rush home to him and say I'm sorry, because that's what we do. You know, I know there's a place in Al-Anon for me. I just can't imagine 12 more steps right now. But I got pulled over for speeding and got my first DUI and was taken up to, it was a little town south of Madison. And it was an experience that fazed me and I felt horrible about, but it wasn't enough for me to stop drinking. That relationship at that point really started heading south. There were broken ribs and there were cuts on my head, and the only reason that he didn't have broken ribs and cuts on his head is because he was stronger than me. I certainly don't condone any violence in any relationship, but I was in many ways as violent as he was. He chose to leave the relationship. with somebody else, and I was forced, I had no choice but to leave. And that's my operation, is I don't leave until I'm kicked, shoved, and thrown out the door. And I moved home in May of 2001, I believe, to a mother who had lost her husband, who for many years she said she despised and hated, but yet, you know, that was their love, and was in the in her cups. And I was really quite shocked at the amount of alcohol she was drinking in the evenings by herself. And at that point, you know, if I could turn the eyes onto myself, I was drinking as much as she was. And I worked in a school. I would get done with school, felt the utter emptiness in my body of not wanting to go home, not having any sort of reason to exist. It felt just rotten. And I would find reasons to stop by this little Chinese restaurant that had a skanky lounge and drink down 4 gin and tonics and then go home with my bottle of wine. That's how it went. It's just, you know, it's no experience that probably is any more or less unique than yours. It resulted in my second DUI. And that one hurt. That one sucked. I was with a deputy sheriff who was too drunk to drive, so I drove her car into the rear end of somebody else's car, and the insanity that pursued was that I received my second DUI and was pretty close to hitting what I consider to be my bottom. In the midst of all this, I had started a relationship with somebody in Florida, somebody that I grew up with, and we did a lot of emailing, a lot of talking on the phone. He had no clue that half the time I was drunk. He came up to visit a few times, and it came down time for me to decide if I was going to move to Florida and decide if this was something I wanted in my life. Well, of course it was something I wanted in my life, because he was going to save me. And when I felt pretty unlovable, somebody wanted to love me. And I truly am grateful for his presence in my life, because my coming to Florida had nothing to do with being in that relationship. It had to do with getting sober. And that's what this journey is. We never know what to expect. And if we assume that we know what this outcome is going to be, a lot of times we're disappointed. That's been my experience. I did move to Florida in the midst of this second DUI. I had no clue how serious it was. I lost my license for 14 months. Had it been in Florida, I would have lost it for 5 years, something to be grateful for. I did go to jail, and that at that point, I realized that I had no right to sit and judge anyone in my family, because none of them had ever been arrested for drunk driving and gone to jail, not even my dad. And I came to Florida. I was able, a month after my second DUI, to take my last drink. It was in June of 2002, and I thought that putting down the drink would be enough. I really, really thought that that would be all it took to make things better. I was going to start this new life, fresh start, with somebody that I cared about. I knew in my heart I didn't love him. The first time I ever saw him, I looked into his eyes and I didn't think I loved him, but he was my best shot for a new life. I lived on the far east side of Orlando and didn't know what to do. I had gained probably, I was close to 200 pounds, and God knew that I needed to have everything taken away from me. My vanity, my sense of self, my ego. And be really given no options. My emotions, that emotional spring Clancy talks about, was out of control. I thought, what could be wrong? I stopped drinking. It's enough. That's enough. That's all I need to do, isn't it? And I would go on the internet and look for things that I was, you know, to try to explain what was wrong with me. I would watch Dr. Phil, and he would tell somebody they're just looking for a soft place to fall. And I wanted a really soft place to fall because I felt like I was falling with no bottom. I got to the point where I couldn't get out of the house. Chad would ask me to go find a job, and I felt paralyzed. Nobody was going to want a criminal, drunken teacher who never taught, you know? And I got sat down one day in December, and I was told that this isn't working. Something's got to give. Maybe you should go back to Wisconsin. I knew if I went back to Wisconsin, I'd be dead. I'd be drinking. I needed to find an alternative. So I went to Lakeside Alternatives. And for those of you that don't know, it's a mental facility that helps people who have no money. And I went to Lakeside and did an intake. And the person that did it gave me a preliminary diagnosis of a bipolar disorder. I had been completely honest about my drinking. At no time did she recommend any sort of treatment or any sort of AA. She said that I needed to see the psychiatrist. I wouldn't be able to see him for 2 months. And that was December, and I knew that my time was running out. I was going to either kill myself, go crazy, kill the boyfriend. I don't know. I was nuts and had nowhere to turn. I happened to call my friend Pat, who lived in Illinois, and she had planned a visit to Orlando, and that's the only reason I called her. And no one knew that she was in Al-Anon. We just started chatting. She asked me how things were going, and I started bawling and said, really bad, bad, it's bad. And I said I was thinking maybe about going to Al-Anon because my mom's been drinking a lot. And she said, Jamie, don't, you know, pass go, do not collect $200, get your butt to AA. And that's all I needed to hear. I needed somebody to tell me to get my butt to AA. And so I got on the computer, found the intergroup website, and found a place I could get to by bus. And I pulled up to the bus. I had to get to the bus, which was a challenge because it was a mile walk. I live in the one place in Orlando where the bus doesn't go. And I remember being really, really, really scared again. But got on the bus and thought, what if nobody's there? What if I get there and nobody's there? And I got there and nobody was there. It was just early before a noon meeting, and I didn't know that the coffee bar was in the back, and I was sitting on the bench waiting for, happened to be Warren, to show up. And he sat down, and I cried. He cried. He's like, you're in the right place. And then came close to the noon meeting, and Warren doesn't, at that time was in the old building, and he didn't go to the little small room, but he knew where I needed to be. And I walked into that small room and found my family. I did. I was beaten, broken, humiliated, and ready for a new way of life. And I'm here to tell you that I got one beyond my wildest dreams. I have been fortunate enough to be open and willing and honest in my sobriety, as honest as I can be. And that's all that I can pray and hope for. And when I got in those rooms, I felt so loved. I went to that noon meeting every day for 30 days, and I'm truly blessed. I am truly blessed because I was dying, and I don't know that there's anybody else in this room that wasn't dying. But when it happens to you and you embrace this program and are so loved if you're willing to accept it, miracles happen every day. And I didn't know that what was missing from my life wasn't just putting down the alcohol. It was filling that hole with a spirit, a power, finding it inside myself. I truly believe that God has been inside me for all these years. You know, I know that I've been in situations where I should have died. And I died emotionally many, 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 many times. And the fact that I can be here, standing here tonight, and feel reborn, truly invigorated, and not dirty or disgusting, hopeful, is truly a gift beyond my wildest dreams. I started regrouping my life and regaining what I never had, never discovered inside me. I am surrounded by people that I know just love me. It's the unconditional love that my dog gave me for years. And it is astounding. I do need to talk a little bit about that spiritual experience. And I am so happy you read that, because that's what this is. This is a journey to find God and a spiritual awakening. Step 12 guarantees us a spiritual awakening if we work these steps openly and honestly as we can. I brought my dog to Florida with me. I love that dog. We traveled many miles together to dog shows, and there came a point in my sobriety where I really felt I wasn't getting the God thing, and got scared when a very close friend of mine went out and thought that I need to get off my tush and get busy. I found the person in my life that had God in her life. I chose to switch sponsors, and I was given a huge gift. You gave me God, as well as everybody else in these rooms. And one of the gifts have been working at a veterinarian again. Little did I know, and this is God's plan, that he planted me in the middle of Spiritual Central. It's freaking amazing. Sorry. My dog, when I recommitted to working the steps, it was about getting connected with God. And God knew that my dog had to go, because I was still hanging on to something material in my life that was not allowing me to feel him inside me. That dog was still giving me the stuff that God needed to give me. And I have a veterinarian that when Simon started seizing and getting ready to check out, he looked at me. I was just a mess when I took him in. And he looked at me and he said, you know, this isn't about you, about the dog. This is about you. And I, what do you mean? He goes, this isn't about the dog. This is about you. And he goes, Simon's going to tell us when it's time to go. And I went home, and I could not. When I made my fear list, losing that dog was at the top of the list. And I could not fathom losing that dog. And I took him in on a Wednesday morning. Well, Tuesday night, I surrendered to God. I said, if this is going to happen and I'm not going to drink over it, I need to place you in my life. I laid on the floor as flat as the Pope does in the middle of the Vatican. You know, I got as low as I could. I refused to kneel for many, 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 many months. But I surrendered. I said, you got to help me through this. Silly dog. And I took him in on Wednesday morning on March 30th. 31st. I had over a year of sobriety. And Doc looked at me and he said, it's time. It's time for Simon to go. And I said, can we do it outside? And he's like, yep. And so he took me outside with my old dog. And he said, when you look in the mirror, you don't see the person we all see. You do not see the beautiful person in the spirit that needs to live. And he said, let this dog give you a gift. You've had a good life together. He needs to go. He's telling us it's time. Let him take all that garbage, all that debris. Let him take it so that you can be the person you're supposed to be in God's eyes. And he put him to sleep, and he had his hand on my dog, and he had his hand on me, and I felt that energy. And as quickly as a cloud went over the sun came back out, and I knew everything was going to be okay as long as I put faith in God. And that's my message to you, that you walk one day at a time, and that God will reveal himself to you if you remain willing, you remain open to travel this path. It ain't always great, but it's sure a lot better than it was. Hallelujah! Thank you.